for it, and with ill grace he put the coin in my hand. "Now be off with you," he said gruffly. "I shall," I said, then added, "The ale needs a bit of aging." Once outside, the man with the white hair stepped to his saddle. He lifted a whip in salute, then rode away. Hastily, I made off down the road in the opposite direction. I had gone no more than a few yards before the two locals who'd been drinking in the tavern came to the door and looked up the road. It was lucky for me they looked the wrong way first, for I saw them, knew what they were about, and ducked through the hedge. Once on the other side, I legged it along the back side of the hedge, then across the corner of the field and over a stone wall. Behind me I heard a shout and knew I'd been seen, so crouching low behind the wall, I ran not away from them, but back toward the lane. I heard them crashing through the hedge, but I reached it on the road above them, ducked through a hole, and crossed the lane and ran swiftly away from them. A low wall loomed before me, and I took it on the run, ducked behind a haycock and then a barn. There, a dog saw me and began barking furiously, but I kept on, knowing they'd be after me now. I'd no doubt the tavern keeper had put them on me. Small though I was, I'd had practice in running these past months, and in dodging and hiding as well. I came out on another, smaller lane, and ran along it, holding to my own direction. There was a village somewhere ahead, but I knew not whether that be good or bad, simply that it was there, and I must consider it. Then the village was before me. But I went around a haycock, along the backside of a barn, and down a wild bit of hillside, away from the village. Now I ran no longer, but moved from cover to cover, keeping an eye out for them. I'd lost them, or so it looked. I came to another lane and followed it away from the village, but the lane suddenly betrayed me, taking a turn around a low hill within sight of the village, for there they were, the two of them, and no chance for me to get away. They spread out a little and came at me. Chapter 8. To flee from them was impossible, for their legs were longer than mine. It was a sunken lane with stone walls on either side, and as they closed in toward me, I suddenly bolted between them. One grasped wildly at my shoulder, and my shirt tore under his hand. Yet I was briefly free of them, and I went up the bank and swung over the wall, sprawling on the earth beyond. My hands closed over dirt, and I came up quickly, frightened. They came over the wall at me, and I flung the dust into their eyes. One man let a fearful yowl out of himself, and both men grabbed for their eyes. At that moment, I saw a stout stick, a twisted branch broken from the hedge nearby. Catching it up, I swung hard on the nearest man and caught him alongside the jaw, and he went down. Then I closed in on the second, whose eyes were busy blinking the dust away. He threw up a hand as I swung my cudgel, but I brought it down, striking him on the kneecap. Then I ran. Across the pasture into which I'd fallen, past a barnyard, and into the lane beyond. On I ran, until I thought my lungs would burst, when suddenly before me there loomed a patch of woods bordered by a wall. I went over that wall and into the woods, pausing, my breath tearing at my lungs, to look back. There was no one in sight. I plodded on into the forest. I was sick of running and desperately worried, for in all this broad land there was no friend to whom I could turn, nor had I a place to go. It was lonely and tired I was, when at last I seated myself on a fallen tree and began to cry. Shamed am I to confess it, but so it was. Lonely and sick with the fear of all that was about me, with enemies all on every hand, I cried. My dear father was in my mind, and my lost home, and the knowledge that I'd no place to go, nor anybody to go to anywhere that was friend to me. "Are you hurt?" It was a girl's voice, and I sprang to my feet, putting a hand across my eyes to wipe the tears. She was standing there, not a dozen feet away, with a great dog beside her, a huge bull mastiff with great jowls. I said, "Are you hurt? There you sit, crying like a great booby. What sort of boy are you anyway?" "I was not crying," I protested. "I was tired. What are you doing here in my forest?"
"Your forest?"
"Yes, mine it is. And I did not invite you here. You are nobody I have ever seen. Are you a gypsy?"
"I am not."
"Well, do not be so proud. I think it not a bad thing to be a gypsy. I've often thought it would be a great thing to go riding about in a red and gold wagon, eating beside the road. I would have white horses, four of them, and I'd have Tiger with me, and..."
"Who is Tiger?"
"My dog. Tiger is his name."
"It is a cat's name.
Tigers are cats,"
I said scornfully.
"It is not. Tiger can be a dog's name also. My father said it could, and my father knows. Anyway," she added, "Tiger does not know it is a cat's name."
"He's a large dog," I said, and then more politely, "I am sorry I am in your wood. I wanted to rest."
"You were not poaching?"
"If you were, and the gamekeeper found you..."
"I do not poach," I replied proudly. "I am sorry I disturbed you. I will go now." Yes, I did not go. I did not want to go. I had talked with no child of my years in many months. She was a pretty child, with large dark eyes and soft lips. "Have you come far?" she asked.
"From very far away," I said.
"Your shirt is torn," she said, "and you have skinned your knee." Looking down, I saw that my stocking was torn and my knee bloody.
"I fell," I said.
"Are you hungry?" she asked.
I have just..."
I stopped in time. If I admitted to eating at the tavern, all would come out, and for all I knew, the tavern keeper was her friend. The tavern could not be that far away. Suddenly I realized they might still be searching for me.
"I must go," I said.
"It will be night soon," she said. "Where will you sleep?" She looked at me curiously. "Will you sleep in a haycock or beside a hedge?"
"It does not matter." I edged away. "I must go."
I turned and took a step, then stopped. "It is a nice wood," I said.
"I did not mean it harm."
"I know you did not." She stared at me. "I think you were frightened of something. And I think you should talk to my father. He is very brave." And she added, "He was a soldier." "I must be going." I started away and then stopped, for there was a man standing there. He was a tall, slender man, with fine features and brown eyes.
"I do not know that I am very brave, my dear," he said, "but I always hoped to be. Who are you, lad?"
My eyes went down the way through the trees by which I had come. I needed to be away from here. I did not want to answer questions, nor to have them discover there had been trouble at the tavern, even if it was none of my doing.
"I was just passing by," I said, "and wished to rest. It seemed better off the road than on it."
He was regarding me very seriously.
The girl came up and stood beside him, taking his hand.
My father had held mine just that way sometimes. The thought made tears come to my eyes, and I brushed them away quickly and turned to go.
"Wait."
He did not speak loudly, but there was command in his tone.
Involuntarily, I stopped.
I asked who you are.
"I am nobody," I said. "I was just passing. I must go."
"Where is it you go to?" he asked. "My daughter is concerned." "To London," I said desperately, wishing to be away.
"I do not think you will reach London tonight," he said quietly. "You had better come along with us."
"I cannot." He waited, just waited, saying nothing. At last I said,
Some men at the tavern are looking for me. They will rob me.
Rob you? He smiled. Are you rich, then?
No. I do not think it matters if one has much. They would take whatever I had.
Who were these men? He persisted.
Reluctantly, I explained what had happened, and how the man with the white hair had stopped the tavern keeper from overcharging me. He frowned thoughtfully. A young man with white hair. Was it a wig, perhaps?
It was his own hair. His face was white, too, like polished marble. Only his eyes seemed alive.
And he spoke for you.
Do you know him, then?
I do not.
I think I know who he might have been, but why he is here, in this place, I do not know. That he even was moved to speak to you, or act in your favour, is amazing.
He did not actually speak to me.
The man changed the subject.
Come with us, lad. At least you can have some supper before you go. And we have a good woman here who might do something for that knee.
But if they find me, do you think they would come to my house?
Lad, do not mistake them. Thieves they may be. Cowards also.
Fools they are not. At least not so foolish as that.
He turned and started back, his daughter beside him, and I walked along with them. A bird suddenly flew up.
What was that? The maid said.
A gold crest, I replied, not thinking.
Do they have them in Ireland, then? Her father spoke so casually that I replied quickly.
Yes.
Then realizing what I had said.
And in Scotland, as well.
He was amused, and it angered me.
The gold crest likes a place where there are evergreens. He chooses to nest among them.
Are you a Scot, then?
I did not wish to lie, and suddenly I realized I did not have to. For long ago were the Irish not called Scots.
It is a loose term, I said, quoting my father. For some Scots were Pictish, and some were Gaelic, and some...
I stopped suddenly, and was silent.
We had come to the path's end, in an open place covered with gravel, where horses could gather for the hunt. The manor before us was old, but gracefully built, and I liked it much. Great old oaks and beeches stood about, and there were stables to one side. They started toward the great steps, but I hung back. The man turned and beckoned me on, but I shook my head.
"I cannot," I said. "My boots are muddy, and I am not dressed."
"It is my house," the man replied quietly.
"Do you come, then? You are my guest."
"I am obliged," I replied. He turned and glanced at me. "Now that you are here, will you dine with us?"
"My clothes," I continued to protest.
"That can be arranged," he replied.
"If you will permit me.
I have some clothes here that would fit you, I'm sure."
"You are a strong-looking lad."
"Yes, I believe they would fit."
To accept charity was not my way. I started to protest, and then realized this was no time for such false pride. He was not offering charity. It was courtesy, and I would do well to accept it as such.
"Very well, if it is no inconvenience."
He led the way himself,
up a wide winding stair to a hall above, and to a room with yellow walls, a blue bed with blue bed hangings, and much blue and white porcelain about. He opened a chest and took from it some clothes, a shirt, breeches, hose, and a coat. There were boots also.
"Water will be sent you," he said,
"and the clothes, I think, will fit."
He paused just a moment.
"They were my son's."
The question came to my lips, but I did not speak, not knowing what to say.
"He went off to sea," he said quietly,
"and was lost there, we think."
"You do not know. Does one ever, when sons are lost at sea? His ship may have been taken. He may be a prisoner. We know not. He may be a slave now in Africa, where many of our sons have ended.
I am sorry."
"Do you bathe now, and dress. In an hour we will dine.
and talk. He turned away and then paused. I do not know who you are, or where you come from, and I have no need to know. Yet I know what you are. And if my son came to another man, I should wish him cared for. He left me then, and soon after a maidservant, a brown-haired lass who shot me quick glances, brought hot water and linens. I made shift to bathe then, and relished the doing of it. Then I donned the clothes they brought me, and when I was fully clad, I glanced at myself in the mirror, and was pleased with what I saw, and surprised too, for it had been many months since I had a mirror at hand. The boy I saw there was me, but a changed me. I was darkened by the sun, leaner somehow, and I looked older. I glanced at myself once again, then went out and closed the door behind me. It was a quiet meal we had, the father, the daughter, and I, the homeless boy. Her name was Evelina, but she was called Eve most of the time. His name was Robert Vipont. The house in which they lived was an old manor, built strongly and well some 100 years before, yet a house with much grace and style within. We talked lightly of this and that, and then, toward the close of the meal, he said, "What do you now propose to do?" "I shall go to London town. It is a large place, and there I might find some way to live." Vipont shook his head. "There are many boys of your age there. Good lads, some of them. Rascals, most. You would find it hard, I think." "I must earn my way. I have no fortune, nor hope of any, but what I can make of my own wit and strength." He studied me gravely, shaking his head. "You are young for that. The apprentices of London are rough lads themselves, and apprenticeships must be purchased." He watched while the maidservant refilled our glasses with ale. Then he said, "You have travelled much, and are no doubt tired. Would you do us the honour to be our guest for a few days?" I hesitated, dearly wanting to agree, yet wary of it. I didn't know this man, and although he seemed generous, I was not sure of his motive. Moreover, I was now accustomed to the rough way of living, and growing daily more so. Might not living here make me soft again? "You know naught of me," I said. "There was trouble at the inn yonder, and it might bring grief upon you and yours. You have been kind, but much as I should like to remain, I must be about my business." "You will stay the night." "If it pleases you, I should be delighted." He paused a moment. "Forgive my curiosity, and I know I have no right to ask, but a lad of your obvious background, there should be a place for you." He looked at me again. "You have obviously gone to good schools."
"I have never been to school. My father was my teacher."
"Ah, a man of rare education, no doubt."
"He was that.
He read me from the writings of Homer when I was very young, and from Virgil too. He taught me much of history, and not of our country only, but others as well. We walked much together, and he instructed me then. We also talked with visitors."
"Visitors?"
Robert Vipont spoke casually, yet I knew the question was an effort to learn something of my background.
"There were few visitors toward the last," I said,
"and mostly from the continent. I had no doubt he knew where I was from, for I had the brogue, although not much of it."
"Were they enemies of England?"
he asked mildly. "My father," I said, "was enemy to no man, and wished harm to no man. He was a scholar, who wished only to be let alone."
"I am not a scholar," Vipont said.
"Would that I were. I have many interests, and much desire to learn scholarly things, but for too long my activities were directed elsewhere." My father had talked to me of his many interests, talked to me as though I were a man grown, discussing not only our bookish interests, but others as well. Often of a night, I had gone to the shore with him, when he would show a light to guide some of the returning wild geese safely to shore. for it was wild geese we called those young Irishmen of family who went abroad to join the armies of France, Spain, Italy, and others. Having no future in Ireland, not permitted by England to have an army, and not wishing to serve England, whom they considered an enemy, they fled overseas, usually aboard some smuggler's craft. Often in my father's house, I heard them talk of politics in foreign lands, of wars, battles, and courtly intrigue, of music, art, and letters. They came by night, and they left by night, catching short visits with friends and relatives, then off to the wars once more. Mayhap when I was older, I could become one of them, or so ran the thoughts in my mind. Yet Vipont was a kindly man, and wished me well. He was hungry for talk with one of his kind, and Eve was also. 2 days I remained, eating too well, talking, riding, and walking with them both. On the third day, we had come to the bottom of the steps for a ride, when suddenly there was a clatter of hooves, and into the yard came 3 red-coated soldiers, and with them one of those who had tried to rob me at the inn.
"See? What did I tell you? There's the Irisher!" he shouted, pointing at me.
The soldiers started toward me, and I sprang to the saddle. My lifelong I had ridden, for my father was a horseman ever, and those fine Irish horses of ours, ah, how I missed them! Turning the horse, I raced around the house, leaped the low hedge, and went down across the lovely meadow and into the old beeches beyond. Under their cover, I turned sharply back, circled a haycock and another barn, and was into the lane. My horse was running hard. Wild was the riding, and beautiful the movements of the horse beneath me. But he was Vipont's horse, and I must free him. There was a place where the lane went by a deep cut in the earth that dropped to the glen below. I left the horse there, with a ringing slap on the rump to keep him running. Then I ducked down into the cleft. Sliding and jumping, I reached the bottom and went into a wooded hollow, crossed it to a stream, and walked into the cold, fresh water. The afternoon was late when I left the stream and went up to the moors above. Long into the night I walked. Then, seeing a vast wood before me, I went into it, deep within it, and lay down at last, covering myself with leaves, and there I slept. Again I was adrift, homeless, alone and hungry. And now I was hunted as well. If they found me, boy though I was, I would die. Chapter 9. I awoke in the cold dark and lay still, confused. I had fallen asleep with my mind filled with thoughts of my boyhood. Now I was a castaway, lying on leaves in a Carolina forest with a stranger for companion and naught but enemies about. I sat up slowly, trying to make no sound. Turley lay still, resting quietly. He too was no doubt accustomed to sleeping in the worst of circumstances. My sword was at hand, and my other weapons. One by one I checked them, all the while listening. It was with difficulty that I shook off the memories of that long-ago night and that wild flight to escape the British soldiers. Yet I had escaped. A week later, starving once more, I had come upon the old man whom I'd seen at the inn, the one who had smiled pleasantly and left, driving his cart with its donkey. But no more of the past. Now was a time for thinking. Now was a time to plan. In my hidden boat lay treasure, far more than I had ever expected to possess. By all the laws of salvage, it was mine. Yet it was not truly mine until I could get it safely abroad and in a secure place. I was beginning to understand that the finding of treasure was the smallest of problems. The greatest problem was to keep it. To do that, I must keep its location secret until I could find a way to transfer it to England, all of which would take planning and foresight. that I had possession of the prize both Don Manuel and the big man, now his captor, were seeking, made it no easier. Once the San Juan de Dios was discovered, the vessel would be looted of its remaining treasure, and I had no doubt they would suspect me of having what was missing, and come searching for me. Moreover, they would not be long in finding the ship, so the time left to me was short indeed. Nor did I wish to take Silliman Turley into my confidence. Many a man has been murdered for less than I possessed, and I had no idea how far Turley could be trusted. Yet, with all my thinking of the gold and the getting of it, my thoughts were shadowed by the memory of Guadalupe Romana. She was in their hands, and she had no knight errant to come riding on a white horse to save her. That she was a clever girl, I was prepared to admit. That she could deal with the big man, I doubted very much. He had a quality of ruthlessness about him that showed no leavening of mercy, consideration, or kindness. He knew what he wanted, and he intended to have it. And he was the type of man to whom no particular woman is important. To such a man, women are something to be taken and then cast aside. Feminine wiles would mean nothing to him. Softly, bitterly, I swore. Turley awakened and lifted his head.
"You were thinking of the girl?" he suggested.
He sat up, brushing leaves from his hair.
"It is ever the way. 7 times out of 10, when a man curses, there is a woman involved. What is it now?"
"She is their prisoner. I must think of some way to free her."
"And then what? You will only have her on your hands. No, my friend. Let her bring trouble to them. They will rue it soon enough. Why, you could do them no more harm than to leave a woman amongst them. She will divide them, split them, create havoc among them. They will argue over her, because of her, and about her. Some will betray others because of her. Some will die because of her. By all means, let her remain where she is. They will be destroyed by it."
"She's a fine girl."
"Ah, would she be as fine, or are you so anxious to aid, if she were ugly? I think not. Worry not about the lass, Captain, and you'll save yourself much and cost them more. And do not forget it. There is evil yon."
I felt so myself. Yet why did that big man seem so familiar? What was there about him that teased my memory? And the other man also. The one who had been lying on the ground, his back to me. She hoped I would help her. She expected it of me.
"No doubt," he replied grimly. "Do not they always?"
He shook his head. "What do they see in her anyway? She is but a woman."
"A woman is sometimes enough. But there is more, or so they believe. They take her to Spain to win from her the knowledge of where some Inca gold is hidden."
"Ah, now she begins to make sense. Gold, is it? And Inca gold, too. How comes the lass by such knowledge?"
"She is but Spanish in part, and the other part of royal Inca blood. As you know, the Spanish demanded a great ransom for the Inca, whom they had seized. Then, when they had the gold, they killed him anyway. What they did not know was that much gold was still on the way, and when they killed him, that gold was hidden. She, they believe, knows where. Also, it is believed that in the mountains there are strongholds where the old Incas still carry on, where the old gods are worshipped, and the old ways continue. And there should be much gold there, too, for it is a metal born of the sun, which is their god. The girl, then, is a prize. I can see, yes, of course. And you, Captain, have an interest in her also? Well, well, Captain, keep your eye upon the gold. It never fades in beauty. Women, they do fade, and they also grow crusty with age, and shapeless. No,
The gold is the thing. Women are forever young when you have gold enough. He was silent. I thought of what I might do. To get Guadalupe Romana away from her captors would be no easy thing. But what to do after that was even more of a problem, for there would be no use in freeing her, only to condemn her to a life in the forest. Somehow, I had to contrive not only to free her, but to see that she found her way home. Worried as I was about my hidden boat and its treasure, there was nothing I could do about it for the moment. So I led the way down through the trees toward the pirate camp, if pirates they were. It was quiet in the woods. Along the sunny side of the trees, near a small creek, the birds were singing, and I heard a loon call across the sound somewhere. Turley put a hand on my shoulder from behind.
"There'll be a watching, Captain. They surely will. You fall into that fat man's hands, and you live long enough to regret it."
We waited, listening. Hearing nothing, we moved along. Suddenly we stopped, for there lay the camp. Don Diego and Don Manuel sat in close conversation. Conchita was at the fire, preparing something. Coffee, if my nose was true. My eyes searched for the Basque, for I thought him a true man, but he was nowhere to be seen, nor Felipe. Several of the pirate crew stood about, all armed, but negligent. They probably had no experience of Indians yet. What were we to do? The fact that I could not see the fat man worried me, for he was the one I wished most to keep under observation. Guadalupe was seated near a tree, close to the trunk of it, almost indiscernible from where we stood. She held a mug in her hand, and from time to time would sip from it. I doubted she was wool-gathering. I believed her attention was probably upon escape, or something of the kind. She was sitting half-faced toward me, and most of the others were facing away. The impulse came upon me suddenly, for if we were to help her, she must know it. Deliberately, I stepped out from the brush where we were concealed. Her mug was lifted toward her mouth, but stopped an instant, then continued. Yet I was sure she had seen me, and I stepped back under cover. A moment later, she stood up and stretched, yet in such a way that both hands extended before her, palms out and toward me. It might have been coincidence, but I was sure she was warning me back with her pushing gesture. She stretched again, then sat down again, where she had been.
"Now what was all that about?"
Turley asked. "She knows I am here, and she was warning me to stay back. So, at least, it appeared." He was sceptical.
"Mayhap. If that was what she did, she was most shrewd about it, and I doubt a woman would think so cunningly."
"She would," I said.
"We'd best lay low, then." He peered around. "The less we move, the less likely we'll be seen."
He peered about.
"We've a good spot here, and should lie ready until they are all within sight, yonder."
"It may be a long time," I said.
"Aye,"
he agreed.
"Do you sleep. I'll wake you an hour or so from now, or if there's movement yonder, then I will sleep."
In the brush where we had sheltered, there were several deadfalls and a place where the brush parted overhead and sunlight came through. There was grass there, and the logs allowed for concealment behind them. Yet their camp was still within view. Down behind one of the logs I settled, and drawing my cloak about me, I slept. Again in my sleep, I went back to my boyhood. What was happening now that inspired these dreams? Or the half-awake pondering on the past? Why now, after all this time, should my thoughts be going back to the days of my first flight? After my escape on Vipont's horse, there followed days of running, hiding, begging for food, working a bit when I could, my clothes going to rags once more, and still no way before me except to keep moving. Then I came upon the kindly-faced old man whom I'd seen so long ago in the tavern before meeting the Vipont's. The cart stood beside a lane. His donkey was feeding upon grass at the roadside. The old man had a fire going, and I walked across the field toward him. He saw me coming, but went on with his business, and I suspected he had been troubled many times along the lanes, and by roads, by those who would rob or annoy him. It was only when I stopped beside the cart that I could be sure. He looked up and smiled.
"You have come a long way."
"I have, and you also."
"It is my way. Once I was..." "No matter. For these 14 years past, this has been my life."
"You were a peddler?"
"Of cloth and trinkets, needles and pins. I am also a tinsmith, and I collect herbs from along the lanes and sell them in the villages or cities."
"You do well at this."
"It is a living. It is enough. I am free. The nights are long and quiet, the mornings cool and bright. I live with the sun, the moon, and the stars. The air is fresh where I am, and there is no one to hurry me or to demand this or that of me. It seems a good life."
He looked at me.
"You are hungry."
I shrugged. "I ate yesterday, and once the day before that."
"Join me. I eat what the way provides, and a little that I buy. Sit you down, or if you will, gather a bit of wood for the fire."
Coming down the slope, I had seen a fallen tree, so I returned to it and gathered broken sticks, some bark, and whatever would add to the fuel. He dished up a bowl of stew and handed it to me.
"Try that," he suggested.
On the tailgate of his wagon, there was a large book opened for reading.
"What is the book?" I asked. "Maimonides."
"You are a Jew?"
"I am English, but one finds wisdom in all languages. I read him often, for he has much to tell."
He looked at me.
"How do you know of Maimonides?"
"My father read him also. We had many, many books, and my father would often read to me. Sometimes we talked of them."
"I have few books now, but they are old friends."
He looked at me sharply.
"Where do you go?"
"To London, I think. I look for employment and to make a place for myself. I have much to learn."
"What is it you wish for yourself?"
"To become skilled with weaponry. The wars offer a young man his best chance, and I would have wealth."
"Wealth? Well, perhaps it has its benefits, but is an empty thing in itself."
"We once had a home. It is now in other hands, and I would have it back. The walls have memories of my father's voice, and the pools there mirrored the features of my mother. My happiest days were spent walking the cliffs with my father, and hearing him tell the tales of Achilles, Hector, and Ulysses."
"Ah, yes. It is good to have roots. I had them once, long ago."
He paused.
"Now I grow old. I am slower than I once was, and loneliness sits hard upon me. I go now to Yorkshire, but after that, perhaps to the edges of London."
I said no word, waiting for what was on his mind. After a while he said,
"If you hurry not too much, you could come with me. You could learn my trade and more. Also, I shall meet soon with friends, and among them there is a gypsy."
"There were gypsies in Ireland, too."
"Aye, they are everywhere. But this gypsy, he is skilled at all the arts of fencing. With whatever weapon you choose, he is a master. He has studied and taught the art in Venice, in Milano, in Paris, as well as in London. Now he travels the roads."
"Why? A man of such skill?"
"There was a duel. He killed a man of noted family and fled. Even now, if they came on him, he would be set upon and killed, or thrown into prison on some trumped-up charge. They did not know he was a gypsy, so they looked not in the places where he is. Now he sharpens blades, shoes horses, and does odd things with metal. I will speak to him, and he will teach you. Believe me, there is none better."
How do you come to be a peddler? You speak as an educated man. Some day we will speak of that. I have education, and once I had position. Now I am nobody. But I am happy. I wanted to ask him more, but something in me warned against it, and I did not. That night beside the fire changed me. From being a fugitive, I had found a place. The following day, 6 miles further along the way, I met the gypsy. What his name was, I never knew, nor why they called him Corey, which was not his name. He was a gypsy not of this land, but of Hungary, Romania, or somewhere yonder. His wagon was alone when we came upon it, and he was squatted by a fire, preparing food. He did not look around until the old man spoke, and then he got up in one smooth, fluid movement and stood facing us. Corey was quite the darkest gypsy I had ever seen, yet his eyes were green, and all the more startling under the black brows and the dark skin. His cheeks were lean and cadaverous, his cheekbones high. He might have been 30 to see him, yet from tales told by the campfire, I knew he must be 60 or more. He moved with the grace and ease of a dancer, and when he saw the old man, his face broke into a smile, revealing gleaming white teeth, startling, as were his eyes, against the darkness of his skin. "Ah, my friend, it is you. How long it has been?" He glanced quickly at me, seeming to take me in with a glance. "You have come to go with me along the roads." "We have." The old man put a hand on my shoulder. "Corey, I have no son, but if I had, I would wish him to be this lad." The smile vanished. Corey looked straight into my eyes, and then he nodded. "You have come to me." "Why?" "He brought me," I said, "for I would learn skill with weapons." I paused. "I wish to become the greatest swordsman in the world." He stared at me, and he did not laugh. "It is a beginning," he said, "to want much. If one is to be, he should try to be the best." His expression changed. "To be the greatest, you must become better than I." "Only you could teach me that," I said. "For cannot the teacher always teach more than he knows?"
"Ah, it is good, that."
He turned his eyes to the old man.
"You have eaten? No? Then join me. I have more than enough, for I knew I would have guests at the fire."
He turned to me.
"We will need wood."
I turned at once and went looking, and he stood watching me, his strange eyes following my every movement. I went up to the fence to go through it, to the other side.
"Jump!"
he said suddenly, and I did. I leaped the fence, and sensing it was some kind of a test, I jumped it again. Then I went through the fence and gathered wood and returned to the fire. Corey talked to the old man of other days and times. Finally he said,
"Why do you wish to fight? Is it that you wish to kill someone?"
"No, but I saw my father die, and he was a fine swordsman. I would be better, and when they come to kill me, I would fight the best of all. Even if they kill me, I would wish to leave my mark upon them. There was one man among my father's killers who was best of all. I would be better." After pausing, I said, "A man's destiny is a man's destiny. I would not look for him, but I think he looks for me. And when he finds me, I would not wish him disappointed in the way I hold a blade."
"Ah!"
Corey ate, and then looked at me again.
"Your father, then? He taught you something?"
"Much, but he was a man of peace. He taught me to fight as a gentleman fights, and so would I, against gentlemen. But there will be others."
"Aye, there are always the others," said the old man.
"Yes."
Corey looked at the old man. "I will teach him."
Again he turned to me.
"It will not be easy. It will be work until your muscles cry out in pain, and work again until the pain is all gone from them. It cannot be done in a month,
or even a year, but I will teach you all I know. And that is more than any other man knows, the old man said. Good. You will find him a good lad.
Yes, Corey said quietly. I know him.
He will walk a bloody trail in the years before him, but the blood that is spilled needs spilling. Today we eat, tonight we sleep, and tomorrow we work.
How swiftly passed the months. How soon came the end of the year. Up and down the lanes of England we travelled, and over the border and into Scotland. We camped beside Hadrian's Wall, and later, by the shores of Loch Lomond. We went down into Yorkshire, and we camped in lonely places. We sharpened knives, scissors, and all manner of blades. We did tinsmithing. We shod horses, and we peddled cloth, thread, and needles. And ever and always, we fenced. By dawn light and campfire, in clearings in the forest, or on the lonely moors, in deserted bars, and wherever we might find a place, we fenced. Always we sought seclusion, for gypsies or vagabonds who had skill with weapons were ill-liked. Also, Corey must keep himself from sight. It would be a hanging for him if he were caught. I was in the hands of a master. My father had been skilled, but Corey was a marvel, no less. At night we read by the campfire, or talked of what we had earlier read, or of our experiences during the day. Sometimes Corey would join in. Usually, he simply listened, smiling infrequently. The old man was called Thomas Bransby. What his true name was, I do not know. Yet as we travelled, I picked up a few things about him. He had gone to the best of schools, had held some official position at one time, and his family had suffered because of it. I guessed that he had been involved, or was suspected of being involved, with one of the numerous factions that had supported the claimants to the throne after the death of Henry VIII. Sometimes we parted from Corey for the day, even for several days, but then he would appear again. As my skill sharpened, so did his, for the constant fencing was renewing his old talents. "It is a wrong name we go by," he said one day. "They call us gypsies because they believed we came from Egypt. It is not so. We were a wandering tribe from India who left there long, long ago. Our words resemble those of the Hindu. Some of our songs are the same, and customs." He was a wise man and had travelled much. During the periods when we stopped for rest, or when I sometimes rode with him on his cart, or walked beside him to save the horses, he talked of his wanderings all over Europe and Asia. He had known many men of importance, serving them in various capacities, or simply travelling with them. His own tribe of gypsies had been largely destroyed by war and plague, yet he was known to other bands, and welcome everywhere. We collected herbs at the roadside. There were many, often thought of as weeds by the unknowing. It was possible to bundle these into small bales, or collect the seeds, and sell them at various shops in the villages, or to doctors, who made their own medicines from them. I was gaining education in much else, too, for Corey told me of the tricks and artifices used by thieves and pickpockets, swindlers, and card sharps. It was an education in the ways of the streets. Little did I know then how much I was soon to need it. Wanderers along the high roads were always in danger from local thugs, who felt secure in attacking or robbing those of us who were considered vagabonds ourselves, having no protection from the law, when there was any. Wayfarers usually banded together, that they might protect one another. At the time when trouble came to us, there were three carts travelling together. Bransby, Corey, and two gypsy brothers who were pugilists, often boxing at the county fairs. They were good boxers both, and better than average at wrestling as well. Frequently, they arranged a match or two with strong boys from the country towns, sometimes winning, sometimes losing.
whichever might be the most profitable at the time, or sometimes whichever might be the wiser. The old man was alone at the time, for I'd been walking with Corey and his cart, but we were only a short distance behind, and the place for our meeting was in a hollow just ahead of us. Bransby had turned the corner, and we heard a clatter of hooves, and then a shouting, and we heard Bransby cry out in protest. While walking, I carried always a stout stick. Grasping it now, I ran on ahead. As I turned the bend of the lane, I saw that a half-dozen young men and boys, all upon horses, had surrounded the cart and were throwing its contents into the road. Two of the boys had pinioned the old man's arms and were laughing at him. Of the others, some remained in the saddle, and the rest had dropped down and were looting the cart. My first glance told me these were no ordinary ruffians, for all were well clad and well mounted. I rushed upon them. One of them heard me coming and turned sharply, raising a stick he carried. Stick fighting was something I had known from childhood in Ireland, and I thrust hard with the end of mine, bending to avoid a counter blow. The end of my stick took him in the wind, and he doubled with a grunt. I knocked his stick from his hand and fetched him a clout across the shins that set him yelling. Two of the others turned on me, but by that time, Corey was coming at a run. And suddenly, the two pugilists burst from the wood where their cart had been drawn up, out of sight. At once, we were in a fierce set-to with fists, sticks and clubs, and I found myself facing a brawny youth, a wide-faced young man with thick, black, curly hair and two ham-like fists. He had turned suddenly on me and caught me off guard, and his first blow sent my stick flying. He would have dealt me another blow then, but I dove under his club and tackled him about the knees. It was like hitting a wall, for his thighs were powerfully muscled, his calves as well, and his feet were solidly placed. He grasped me in his two huge hands, pulled me away, and swung a blow at my face. Jerking back, I tried to break free, and did succeed in avoiding the blow, but never had I felt a grasp so filled with sheer power. I was off my feet, but I kicked out, catching him on the kneecap. He winced, his grip relaxed, and I broke free. He lunged at me, but suddenly Corey was there, the handle of an axe in his hands. "Do it," he said, "and I will smash your skull." Powerful as he was, the young man was no fool. He stepped back and looked at Corey. "Oh, yes," he said. "I shall stop for now. But we'll have the lot of you up to prison for this." "You attacked us," I protested. He smiled smugly. "That won't be so when I tell it," he said. "And my father is a power here. I will see all of you hang. There's a highwayman about here, and I will swear," he pointed a thick finger at Corey, "that you are he, and that the rest are your confederates." "I shall see you hang," he said grimly, "and when you do, I shall smile." Two of the others were getting to their feet. One lad, scarcely older than I, was still on his horse. "If you have attacked us in this manner," Bransby said, "you will have abused others. It is in your nature. We will find those others. We will get our own witnesses." The young man smiled. He was perhaps 18 in years, 4 years older than I now was. "None will speak against me," he replied cheerfully. "All about are my friends, or they live in fear of what may follow. Oh, I shall see you hang, all right. I shall have the witnesses, and my family owns all about here. You will see." "What a beast you are," I said coolly. "You are a bully, and no doubt a coward as well." He looked at me tauntingly. "A bully? Oh, yes. I like being a bully to all you riffraff, you vagabonds. But a coward? That I do not know, and I never shall, for I am larger, stronger, and a better swordsman than any about. I can defeat them all. As for you, had they not fallen around me, I should have beaten you blind. That was what I intended, you know, to blind you. I shall do so yet, and these others also, if they live. He turned, gathered up the fallen reins of his horse, and swung to his saddle. Come, he said to the others. I must arrange for these to be taken. Abruptly he rode off, and the others followed. All but the lad who had not dismounted. He lingered a bit. I am sorry, he said. I am just lately come home, and did not know what he has become. Be off with you, for he will do as he says. His father is a lord here, and will hear no evil of him. He is a tremendous fighter, and a bad one, evil in all ways. He can do everything he says. He looked at me. You, he said, he will hate. I know. Get away if you can. He rode off and over the rise. Corey moved swiftly. He turned to Porter Bill, the nearest of the two pugilists. Get your cart and follow me. There is a lane yonder. We fled. Yet our carts could move but slowly, and I wondered what it was Corey had in mind. Yet there was some plan, for he was a gypsy, as were Porter Bob and Porter Bill, the twin fighters. We ran our donkeys and ponies until, a short distance along, he turned sharply into a lane past a haycock. Behind him, he replaced the bars of a gate and brushed out the tracks of our turning. We ran our animals a mile, then another half, until we came upon some old haycocks, and he turned from the hidden lane down which we had travelled. In the field, he pulled aside some hay. There was an opening there, for the haycocks were old and were like hives. There was room under them for three carts, four if need be. Swiftly we came out, rearranged the hay, and mounted upon the animals. We were one shy, and I shook my head at them. Go, I said. I shall meet you later. I can run and hide afoot. I have done it most of my life, it seems. Do you try to escape? They hesitated. Then Corey tossed me one of the two sticks he carried. See? It is a sword, Cain. Use it if you need. And they were gone. They were gone, and I was alone. Alone once more. Quickly, I looked about. There was little time, nor did I need any warning when it came to that big youth. I had seen the look in his eye. He was one who thrived on cruelty. Turning swiftly, I went down the hill. Chapter 10. There was no time to think, no time to plan. Distance was what I needed. I guessed that my mounted friends would head south and try to lose themselves among the lanes. They would scatter out, too, taking their loss as they would, or sending gypsy friends back for their hidden carts. I ran down the slope to a stream, then along it, under the trees to a lane. I knew not how much estate was claimed by the father of the large young man, nor which direction would find me safest, but I fled. My condition was good. Well over a year of travelling along the lanes and byroads, walking much of the time, always active, fencing, boxing, wrestling, had left me in fine shape. It angered me to be treated so shamefully by the leader of those rascals. There were many of their kind about, young ruffians, albeit of good family, taking advantage of their position to raid and bully and steal. No man was safe from them, and no girl either. They were thoroughly vicious. We had lately crossed a wild and broken moor, not too far from the sea. It was there that I directed my steps. Once, when I had begun to climb, I looked back. Parties of riders could be seen sweeping along the lanes. I kept from sight and plodded on. Soon they would come this way, and I must find a place to hide. Wandering the lanes as we did, We usually paid small mind to where we were, and I only knew that somewhere off to the west lay the sea. We were in the lake country or near it, and as once I had fled to the sea and escaped, it was in my